What are you covering today? What you playing?
Well, I'm going to do a lot of the cranking the numbers and the statistics.
Okay.
And John Nichols, Lever Time from Dave Sirota.
Okay.
Podcast I'm going to play that go through the statistics because the numbers are still not completely in.
They're not in yet.
We don't know what the overall turnout is, but it looks like people were on the couch, basically. They didn't come out.
Well, Paul, we will be listening.
Less people voted for Trump than
less.
This time.
Right, yeah. Even on both sides, too. Yeah, you see that?
Yeah. It's
something to think about, but thank you so much for allowing us to have a minute or two of your time.
Oh, well, I called in and then I barged into your show, so... That's not Paul's corner, but
peace and love.
I cornered my way in. Thanks. Keep up the good work. And because there's going to be a whole lot more of it. Like I said, insulating people in Illinois from mass deportations and whatever else we can do. Going to play an underwriting announcement here at the top because... I often forget. I should probably just learn to read these, but you need a relief from my voice here. And we appreciate local businesses. I always call out the chess club. If there is a chess club, why don't they underwrite here at WEFT? Because community media is going to be even more important than ever in this impending apocalyptic. Okay, I'll get on what I can. I'll let you know what are these podcasts are. Got Amy Goodman's commentary. Mumia Jamal Abu Jamal has not done a commentary in a long time. I'm kind of wondering about him if he's just going to fade away like his other political prisoner colleague Leonard Peltier. He does have a new compilation of books, a compilation book with a co-author, Mumi Abu Jamal does. So maybe that's what he's doing. Maybe he's working on writing. Anyway, here's an underwriting announcement for our neighbor down here in downtown Champaign.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Live Action Games. If you're looking for a wide selection of classic and modern video games, consoles, controllers, books, and collectibles, Live Action Games has you covered. Live Action Games is open Tuesday through Saturday at 111 North Market Street in downtown Champaign, right next door to WEFT. New and gently used inventory arrives daily. For a list of in-stock items or additional Live Action Games information, please visit lag217.com or call 217-359-4863. That's 217-359-GAME.
Well, thanks, Eric. That was well read. Here's Amy Goodman's Breaking the Sound Barrier, and hopefully I'll be back with whatever the three podcasts I'm putting on. I mentioned Lever Time. There's still a Deconstruct It with Ryan Grimm, even though he's with the new Drop Zone site along with his colleague Jeremy Scahill, but they have some kind of arrangement with their previous employers that they do a podcast on a grant from them, which is an arrangement beyond my comprehension. So here's Amy.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Donald Trump will become president of the United States on Monday, January 20th, 2025. Until that time, though, President Joe Biden remains in the Oval Office. Biden spoke to his cabinet and staff Thursday in a Rose Garden address.
Now we have 74 days to finish the term, our term. Let's make every day count. That's the responsibility we have to the American people.
There is much Biden can and should do in this lame duck period before disappearing over the horizon in one final trip aboard the presidential helicopter Marine One, unless he takes the train to Delaware, as he proudly did throughout his Senate career. He has a narrow window in which to act and could do significant good, repairing some of his own mistakes and blunting some of what Donald Trump has pledged will begin on day one. First and most importantly, Biden should suspend all arms shipments to Israel. period. Not one more bomb, not one more bullet. Israel's mass slaughter of civilians in Gaza is increasingly described as outright live-streamed genocide. The Israeli military is now forcing the entire population of the northern quarter of the Gaza Strip to leave for the south. This follows the release of the general's plan, drafted by retired Israeli military officers, calling for the systematic denial of humanitarian aid in the north, which has been labeled ethnic cleansing. Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported this week, quote, "The army has begun the stage of cleansing the northern strip while it prepares to hold on to the area for a long time to come," unquote. Israel is using U.S. taxpayer-funded arms to decimate Palestinians in Gaza in clear contravention of U.S. and international law. The people of Gaza are trapped, under siege, surrounded by the Israeli army and navy with armed drones, helicopters, and military jets overhead. They're being driven from their homes, starved, bombed, shot by snipers, killed by tank shells, and forced to live without clean water, sanitation, functioning hospitals, or the basics of survival. Every aspect of their society, their culture, their history is being erased by Israel's unrelenting bombardment and by smiling, selfie-snapping IDF demolition crews. None of this would have been possible without Biden's support. Haaretz also reported in early September that a, quote, senior Air Force official told Haaretz that without the American supply of weapons to the Israeli Defense Forces, especially the Air Force, Israel would have had a hard time sustaining its war for more than a few months, unquote. A leaked letter to Israel from Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin demanded Israel immediately allow U.S. humanitarian aid shipments to Gaza or face an interruption in arms shipments. They gave Israel until November 13th to comply. But the laws governing arms shipments don't include a month-long grace period. The cessation is supposed to be immediate. Nevertheless, as the deadline approaches and with the situation in northern Gaza becoming more catastrophic by the day, it seems that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a staunch Trump ally, has no intention of allowing in aid. Domestically, Biden could preempt some of the violence expected from the incoming Trump administration. Biden promised to end the federal death penalty when he was campaigning in 2020, after President Trump ordered the execution of 13 federal death row prisoners in his final 6 months in office. With the stroke of a pen, Biden could commute the sentences of the 40 current federal death row prisoners to life in prison. This would empty federal death row, denying Trump the opportunity to engage in another killing spree. Biden could also commute the sentences of the four prisoners awaiting execution on the U.S. military's death row. Biden could also impact Trump's anticipated mass deportation that was a central pledge of Trump's campaign. Law professors Peter Markowitz and Lindsay Nash from the Benjamin Cardozo School of Law at Yeshiva University in New York have revived an argument proposed by scores of advocacy groups in the waning days of the Obama administration that, quote, the president possesses the constitutional authority to categorically pardon broad classes of immigrants for civil violations of the immigration laws and to thereby provide durable and permanent protections against deportation, unquote. Biden could act on the admittedly novel legal theory by granting millions of undocumented immigrants relief from the myriad and often violently inflicted injustices of the U.S.'s failed immigration policies. Such a move would certainly be challenged in court, but would potentially slow down what will almost certainly be a horrendous attempt by Donald Trump to deport up to 12 million U.S. residents. People are organizing now on how to resist the incoming Trump administration. Biden could join them by using the constitutional powers of the Office of the President of the United States, the most powerful position on earth. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan. Biden can make every lame duck day count by stopping.
Indeed. That's the first I ever heard of that. I guess I missed that episode on Democracy Now. I have to go back. I never heard of that. that power that she cited there. He could also commute the sentence of Mumia Abu-Jamal and Leonard Peltier. Why not do something while you're a lame duck? Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others. Now we're going to go to Jeff Weaver, interviewed by David Sirota from Lever Time. Sirota, well, I don't know what to say about him. The the bio here for Jeff Weaver is that he was the architect of Senator Bernie Sanders' two presidential runs. The first one was sabotaged by the DNC in California, and things had been entirely different if that hadn't happened, right? The title of this podcast from November 8th is How Democrats Can Win Back the Working Class. And I may play more of this than I thought. We'll see how it goes. I was going to excerpt this and make sure we got some John Nichols on from Madison. But we'll see how that goes. The other segment was, to be announced. But hopefully this is cued about right. Jeff Weaver worked with Sanders from Lever Time.
Hold on to the area for a long time to come, unquote. Israel is using U.S. taxpayer-funded
When did that start playing over and over?
Giving, you know, the wealthiest people in the country a giant tax cut. That will be certainly extending those tax cuts is going to be a major part of this next administration. His largest funder is the richest man on the planet.
Right.
Who is running around trying to rebirth Paul Ryan era austerity politics, promising he's going to cut $2 trillion from the federal budget, which, you know, he's not going to be able to do that. But if he did, that is more than all federal government discretionary spending.
Yeah,
that is the level that we're talking about here. So, no, I don't buy it. I think, you know, it's hard.
That's a Lever Time episode with Crystal Ball. Actually, it's the same episode, but that wasn't the cue point that I wanted to, but it was interesting to hear that little bit. Austerity. They're warning about austerity even while they were campaigning. At least Elon Musk was, but maybe he was off script.
Your data is being removed and protected. Go to levernews.com/data right now and get 55% off an annual.
The vagaries of playing something fresh like this just from November 8th and on a podcast.
There's no danger in trying it out to claim your.
But Lever Time does have a premium podcast too, and that they did some great work, or doing some great work with that as well. But this is one of the free ones.
Five exit poll stats that blew your mind that tell what you think is the story of the election.
Well, look, the story of the election is, there's really two stories of the election. One of which is, although we now talk about it in terms of education, really what the breakdown was in this election was about class. It used to be pollsters asked people in their polls about their income, which they don't do anymore. They use education as a proxy for that. And if you look at, and I'm scrolling here through some exit polls from CNN, incredible erosion of support among working class people, particularly voters of color. Voters of color, no college degree, which again, when we say no college degree, we mean this is working class people. Clinton margin plus 56, Biden plus 46, Harris plus 30. That's among voters of color. The margin among white college educated women goes up. I mean, actually all the messaging they did during the campaign, her margin went up. She had almost double the margin among college-educated white women as Hillary Clinton had. So tremendous upsurge of support there. Women with white women, no college degree, sort of flat. So what we're seeing is this incredible flight of basically people of color, working-class people of color, from the Democratic Party. Latino men, Clinton plus 31, Biden plus 23, Trump plus 12. Among Latinas, Hillary has 44%, plus 44%, Biden plus 39%, Harris plus 22%. Her margin among Hispanic women is cut in half. I don't know if you saw this statistic. It was in Newsweek. The most Latino county in America had a swing. Trump won it by 16. Hillary won it by 79 points. Biden won it with by 52 points. So there's this tremendous swing among the working class in this country. And of course, nobody wants to talk about that.
Well, I want to talk about it. And I want to ask the question I think I have my own thoughts on, but I want to hear your thoughts, which is a sort of typical liberal might ask. I don't understand why people lower down on the economic scale would vote for real estate mogul Donald Trump, whose campaign centered Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, whose campaign, what was it, three quarters of the billionaire money spent in the election went to Donald Trump. Why would the working class, why would there be a class shift of the working class to a candidate like that?
Well, there's a few things, but let me just address the Elon Musk thing. Of course, we put Mark Cuban front and center. I like Shark Tank as much as the next person, but you know, Mark Cuban should not be the face of the Democratic Party, who was there just to push crypto deregulation. Let's be clear. So you know, we had our own billionaires out there as well. But the reason is that the Democratic Party has not offered a counterbalancing narrative, in large part, to what the Republicans have offered. Times are tough for a lot of people. They have a narrative. It's completely false, of course, about immigrants and people of color and what have you, right? We don't have one. What's our narrative? Biden, Joe Biden, corporations are good. People are good. Congress is good. I'm good. You're good. We're all good. Bad things happen to good people sometimes. You know, their response to inflation was horrendous. We got hit, as you know, by experts with their macroeconomic numbers. You know, when your real wages are going down, do you really care how much the GDP has gone up? That just means that Mark Cuban is getting more money and you're getting less. That's even worse, right? In some ways, it's even worse. Oh, everybody's doing great except you.
right.
Right. So you should really feel really bad. You're really a bad person.
It's like a status message. Like, it's,
yeah,
like
right,
your
exactly.
Comparative status is actually worse.
You're going down. And it's probably your fault because everybody else is doing well. Why aren't you doing
right,
better?
Right.
Everybody else can afford the $8 eggs. Stop complaining. You know, you see this. Bill Maher the other night on his show had a statistic where the average income in Alabama and Mississippi was $85,000, you know, higher than in England or Canada. But of course, you know, you and I know that there's old people in Mississippi and Alabama who die every year in the summer because they don't have air conditioning or can't afford air conditioning. So, you know, I mean, that's one of the parts of the country where the greatest wealth and income disparities are in those places. And there's no recognition of that. And so they would rather frame this as an issue of education. So on one side, we have the educated, smart people. And then the other side, we have like the troglodytes, Neanderthals, racists, misogynists. They're over there. If they'd only gone to college, they'd be voting with us because they'd know better. And they don't want to acknowledge the elephant in the room. Pardon the pun. But it's class. The class is the issue. And it's why they're losing voters of color in this country who are, you know, many of whom are put off by the, you know, the sort of virtue signaling. It comes out of the Democratic Party, the, you know, the pronoun checking and those types of issues. You know, we need to move toward a party that is more economically populist and socially libertarian.
So the question then becomes, why hasn't the Democratic Party done that? I will offer a theory. The Democratic Party knows these lessons. The data has been accumulated from 2016 to 2020, now to 2024. The idea being that the Democrats are losing working class voters while they are not making a strong class-based appeal on economic issues. They are not naming the villains. As I said to a friend recently about Bernie Sanders' speeches at his rallies, why do people come to see Bernie Sanders' speeches at his rallies, knowing that he's going to say much of what he's already said in the past? And I say that as somebody who wrote speeches for him. And the answer is that I think people like to just hear somebody in politics naming the villain. I think that I honestly think that's what it is. There's something therapeutic and cathartic about it. So the Democrats, I think they're not, the people who run the party aren't stupid. They know this, but they have eschewed class-based politics, I think, because they are always looking for a way to appeal to voters, but also placate the donor class. And so that leaves you with a very narrow set of issues that you can talk about. What are the set of issues that you can talk about that voters want that don't offend the donor class? It's like reproductive rights. It's like LGBTQ rights, not unimportant issues, but you're going to be less interested in talking about the economic issues that maybe threaten the financial interests of your donors. That's my theory. Do you agree? And if you agree that that's the problem, then how do you break that problem? How can the Democratic Party break away from that fundamental, essentially, conflict of interest?
I think you've framed it, you know, writ large well, but I do think there's sort of a way in which a sort of insular group of people reproduce themselves. You know, the Democratic Party leadership is elected out of a small group of people. In many cases, those elections at the state levels involve very, very few people. The president appoints a huge number of members of the DNC who all reflect that. It's a self-perpetuating virtue cycle, where if you don't agree with the whole list, you're out. You know, we've seen this on the left too, by the way, so it's not just among mainstream Democrats. But as you know, David, because you worked in the Congress with me, you worked for Dave Obey, by the way, who was not a great pro-choice champion in the world. You know, when I came to Congress with Bernie Sanders, there were a lot of Democrats who were pro-life. There were a lot of Republicans who were for gun control, right, who were in the suburbs, who now have been replaced by Democrats. So there's Democrats who were pro-life are now been replaced by Republicans. You know, there is a judgment, a litmus test around these social and cultural issues. Instead of having an attitude of saying, you know what, my rights stop where yours begin, and you live your life, I'll live mine. You don't need to convince me of the validity of your life, and I don't need to convince you of the validity of mine. We'll just agree to coexist and not interfere with one another or hamper one another. That used to be more of the attitude. That is not the attitude now. And you see it reflected among party leaders. That, you know, people feel preached to. And they don't want to feel preached to. People feel looked down upon. People feel denigrated as ignorant or racist. And, you know, look, there are racists in this country. There are racist structures in this country which have to be dismantled. But most people don't perceive themselves as racist. Even if you want to are working to break down those structures, telling people they're racist is really not the way to do it, frankly.
Yeah, well, that's a good segue to what's your response to the Kamala lost, just like Hillary lost, because of misogyny, and with Kamala, misogyny and racism. That's, you're already seeing that. You know, boil up that there's going to be an effort to create a narrative around that. What do you make of that? What would, true, not true?
Well, I don't think black men are not racist, and yet we've seen their support of the Democratic candidate go down from Hillary to Biden, who had less of a margin with black men. So it was clearly not about her being a woman, because fewer of them supported Biden, and now fewer of them are supporting Kamala Harris. Latinas, you know, giving half of the margin to Kamala Harris that they gave to Hillary Clinton. They gave, and Biden was sort of in the middle. So clearly that trend line has nothing to do with race and or gender. That is a way of not having the real conversation.
Is there anything to the idea that there was an information ecosystem gap, if you will? And what I mean is that in the closing days of the campaign, you saw Donald Trump and J.D. Vance go on Joe Rogan's podcast. Kamala Harris didn't go on Joe Rogan's podcast. You know, she was appearing on podcasts like Call Her Daddy, though. But basically that to be able to reach not just a minority of voters, but what sounds like to reach a significant amount of voters, the kinds of voters who will be able to swing an election in one direction or the other, candidates have to go into these niche media ecosystem, whether that's Joe Rogan's podcast, Alex Cooper's podcast, The Undertaker's podcast. And that was somewhere that the Harris campaign either seemed to struggle with, or maybe more that the Trump campaign really excelled at. But what do you think about the media ecosystem idea, and that now campaigns have to really look at the ecosystem as a constellation of different enterprises versus, you know, we're going to deal with the Washington Press Corps, and then there's the local and regional press corps. Now you have to really look at it more as a map rather than a linear group of media organizations you're talking to.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you know, David, again, from the Bernie campaign, we know Bernie went almost anywhere they would have him because he wanted to talk to people. He didn't care about the host or the host's views. He wanted to talk to the audience. You know, he was criticized loudly by many in the Democratic Party for being one of the first people to really go on a Fox. He did it at Fox Town Hall in Pennsylvania. That was the infamous town hall when they asked the Fox-picked audience whether they supported Bernie Sanders' socialist healthcare plan, and everybody in the audience raised their hands to the shock of the moderators. So, yes, there is. I think the other problem is that the mainstream media is now viewed as a partisan. So you have Fox, which is clearly the Republican side. You have MSNBC. They call it MSDNC, not unfairly. They call it that. I mean, CNN has had a Dr. Frankenstein problem since 2016 when they helped elect Trump. They've been trying to kill him since. If you watch Jim Acosta's show on CNN in the morning, the guy should be on Kamala Harris's FEC report. I mean, it's incredible. I supported Kamala Harris and opposed Trump, but you just watch it as a political observer and you're like, holy smokes, this guy is a commercial for Kamala Harris. Other forms of media, just are not big enough in many ways to break through. But I do think it is a mistake to not talk to as broad a swath of voters as you can with some kind of virtue signaling about Joe Rogan.
I mean, I would also add to that there's a chicken or the egg problem here. The Democrats and the Democratic infrastructure has been hostile to alternative media conduits in a way that the Republicans haven't. And that's been for, 10, 15 years. So the point is that alternate independent media that the Democrats could try to cultivate and build is a longer term project to get to a point where engaging with them in an election is worthwhile and reaching a large audience. The Republicans have worked to create that. The Democrats haven't. And so here we are. It seems like most Democratic elected officials are most obsessed with getting booked on MSNBC, whereas Donald Trump is running around to, anybody that's got any kind of audience to try to connect him with disaffected voters, right? I guess what it's saying is there's almost a class analysis in there, is that the Democratic elected leadership and sort of party structure is interested mostly in talking with the kinds of voters that it did well among, which are sort of elite, affluent, upper middle class liberal voters, not necessarily interested in talking to a larger audience. Do you agree with that?
Well, I do, but I would say this. I think there's a lot of people who would take the Trump example in the Democratic Party establishment who would say that that's a dangerous thing, right? These platforms give someone like Trump a voice. If you open it up on the Democratic side, you might be giving a left populist voice who would then displace them, right? I mean, Trump has displaced a lot of the traditional Republican power structure. That to them is not that's not a lesson learned for them. That's not a positive. You think the members of the DNC are really interested in having a left populist voice go out on a liberal or the Democratic blue media of some kind and like blowing them away? I don't think so. So Trump's success may reinforce the worst in those folks.
Yeah, I mean that's a really interesting point. I mean it's sort of like what are the incentives of the Democratic Party? Talk to us a little bit about that. This idea that the Democratic Party presents a brand of we're trying to win elections, but the internal dynamics of the Democratic Party are such that there is a lot of self-preservation. I mean, that's like any organization. Like individuals are interested in preserving their own power, their own wealth, their own ability to make a living, et cetera, et cetera. But it seems like what you're alluding to is that there's kind of a conflict of interest at the heart of the Democratic Party, that staying in power in the Democratic Party as it exists now, no matter how many elections it's winning or losing, seems to be the top priority and the top the sort of pervasive culture of the Democratic Party, not necessarily winning elections. I guess what I'm getting at is the idea of winning elections, being more electorally powerful, but reshaping the party so that the people who are in the party right now have less power. That's a battle because you're battling with self-interest. You're battling with people who are trying to hold their territory. Is that basically right?
Well, it's true as an outsider. I mean, those individuals are convinced that they're the presentation of the issues and their framing is correct, like they believe it themselves that, you know, they're being that they're right and that the rest of the country is wrong. I mean, that's a difficult position to hold in a democracy and be successful. You know, other countries, when you have bad elections, they replace leaders in both parties in this country. That doesn't happen. You lose an election in England, the party leader who's in the prime minister does not become the minority leader. That person is out.
Right. I was going to ask about that. I mean, Zephyr Teachout wrote a piece in the Nation saying that Chuck Schumer needs to resign. And I think it's fair to say in most other countries, when you get shellacked in an election, it's like, goodbye. That doesn't seem to be happening. I mean, maybe it'll happen now. I guess it gets to my question of, if the Democratic Party can't change leadership now after this kind of election, what does it say about the party itself? What does it say about American politics? Like, how could it not have to change after what just happened?
Look, you know, I think what a lot of people are going to rely on is Trump self-destructing. They're going to say, oh, look, he got in there. People now are going to remember why they got rid of him last time. And so, you know, if we just hold on, we'll win in the midterms, and then we'll retake the presidency, you know, and the insanity will be over in 2028. Of course, the insanity was supposed to be over in 2020, but the insanity will be over in 2028, and we'll move on. And, you know, these people have convinced themselves that Trump is some kind of anomalous,
right.
Unicorn. You know, leaders don't make history. History makes leaders. And, you know, he's taking steps now to institutionalize his brand of politics and Republican Party. You know, his vice presidential running mate would be probably worse for the country than Trump, I have to say, because he'll be more effective and more focused in an ideological way on changing the nature of government and its relationship to people.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. The idea of a smarter authoritarian whose personal behavior doesn't get in the way of implementing the authoritarian agenda, that is J.D. Vance. And his code switch in the debate to sort of normal guy.
Yeah.
I think that, I mean, my take on Vance is it took him a very long time on the campaign trail to realize that he would be more effective by code switching to normal guy rather than like MAGA base guy. It was really weird, actually, because he was already the VP nominee, meaning he wasn't in a primary, and yet he was sort of running in the general as a primary presidential candidate appealing mostly to the base. Something in his brain switched, or he got a good piece of advice that, wait a minute, I'm already in the general election. I'm going to use this debate to code switch to like general election normal guy. And it was really effective.
And I think the answer is, and I say this not loving the answer, because I don't want my kids to go to school in a school that feels unsafe or where there are visible signs of security. But I unfortunately think that we have to increase security in our schools. We have to make the doors lock better. We have to make the doors stronger. We've got to make the windows stronger. And of course, we've got to increase school resource officers, because the idea that we can magically wave a wand and take guns out of the hands of bad guys, it just doesn't fit with recent experience. So we've got to make our schools safer. And I think we've got to have some common sense bipartisan solutions for how to do that.
Vance is just as, if not more, dangerous than Trump, because he comes off as a relatively normal person.
And I think he has an ideological foundation. You know, Trump doesn't really have an ideological foundation. I mean, he's authoritarian. He jumps all over the place. It's not a coherent ideology that underpins his policies. But with Vance, there is.
Yeah, Vance has a way he sees the world. He's got a narrative that he tells. I mean, I just saw him. I saw a clip of him on Rogan, by the way, talking about how the railroad companies hate him because he's the one who's called them out for socializing the costs of their misbehavior.
So I talked about this train disaster in East Palestine, and you know the railroad companies hate me because I kind of went on a crusade against them afterwards. And what I realized is, think of all the costs of that disaster. Think of the healthcare costs, the welfare costs from people who lost their jobs, the declining home values in that community, just all of the costs absorbed by that community. And the railroads are paying slap on the hand fines. And it sort of occurred to me that the reason they're not more serious about these train disasters is because they're privatizing the rewards. But when a major train disaster happens, who picks up the tab? It's the local residents and it's the American taxpayer. And that's something that fundamentally has to change.
That's amazing. That's from a clip from the Joe Rogan show as presented on Lever Time. Yeah, but he's for deregulation, right? So, but it just happened that this massive disaster happened in his district or in Ohio where he's senator. Okay, that's how Democrats can win back the working class. Obviously going all over the place with Dave Sirota and Jeff Weaver. And it includes Crystal Ball. That's really her name, apparently. political analyst in the first part. She has a podcast, I guess, called Breaking Points. I'm not sure about all of that, but I thought I'd present some kind of analysis. And the numbers at the beginning were quite interesting. How Democrats can win back the working class. I'm worried that this business about dumping on identity politics, as if you can't do identity politics and also talk about class. One of the big things in identity politics is reparations, it seems to me, and that's a class issue. That's dispossessed people, people that were brought over as slaves, never gotten their wealth, and then just recently there's a book out, and I heard a book chat about it, of a story of the Freedman Banks, about how it was led by Frederick Douglass. They got him as a figurehead, even though they knew the bank was going down, and pretty much stripped it of assets, and many of the freed slaves who invested in it lost all of what they had gained. Amazing story. So that's why you can't separate the two, it seems. It's race and class and gender, and it makes everything complicated, but then everything is complicated. Okay, we're going to switch to John Nichols straight away here. This is from What Happened and What Do We Do Next? Momentarily, we should be starting it up. I guess there's probably an ad here I have to cull. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. We're going to hear John Nichols of The Nation magazine in conversation on the podcast Start Making Sense. I should have an announcement here to read for WEFT. I know there's still a lot going on around, but maybe I'll just make the open appeal that community media is more important than ever. Resources like Democracy Now! And all other alternative media, other places, extremely important to support now. So if you haven't made it, or if you want to throw some more in the till, that would be an excellent idea. Radio Free Labor coming up. Maybe they'll sort out what happened with this $12,000 signing bonus with the would be very interesting to hear what they make of it. I'm trying to figure out how much typical signing bonus is. This is about the Machinists Union. Machinists Union used to be one of the most progressive. I don't know what happened. Now the electricians are perhaps the most. But I did have an announcement I wanted to make about the immigration services of ICU. You send a picture of a piece of furniture or some item in your household that you want to get rid of, and they'll help get it to people that are sleeping on the floor, on a pallet on the floor, as it were. If you have a mattress or something, they've placed a lot of those, and that's ISCU, Immigration Services of Illinois. I attended a talk by a really dynamic worker with that group. And I'm supposed to have a web page here with that information on it. But you can just Google ISCU and find out about that program. Okay, here's John Wiener with John Nichols on State Making Sense. This is a little bit earlier, November 6th, but there's digesting. And as I called in on the Start Higher Ground show with Aaron and reprised it when I was sitting in with them, it's still astonishing that we don't know the composition of the House. It's probably going to be a trifecta and be all Republican, but there's still a possibility that it would be a one-vote or two-vote margin one way or another. Here's John Nichols.
We reached him today at home in Madison. John, it is very good to talk to you on this very bad news day.
I am honored to be with you as always, John. And I can tell you that it is a bad news day, but as a reporter, I can tell you we don't know how bad, or maybe even if there are a few rays of sunlight.
I should say we are speaking on Wednesday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon Eastern time, and we don't yet have complete results on the three or four key Senate races. We don't have results from the West Coast states, especially California, which will take a week or two until we may know the final results of all those House races. The big picture at this hour is that Trump carried the swing states and along the way brought down some of our best senators. Seems like a landslide in the Electoral College and in control of the Senate, and that means the consequences are huge. But the change in the vote in the swing states was actually quite small. Trump got one or two, or in some cases, 3 points more than Harris there. And Trump's total in the popular vote, 72 million, is actually smaller than he got 4 years ago when he got 74 million. Obama's victory was much bigger than Trump's. Reagan's was much bigger. And of course, nothing compares with LBJ. What for you is the big picture of what went wrong?
Well, a lot went wrong. Let's be clear about that. And I think it's important to emphasize a lot, right? Because it wasn't just one thing. And first and foremost, I think it's important to understand this has been an incredibly chaotic year. I remember in the summer, talking to a friend of mine and saying, look, in the last 10 days, we have seen an assassination attempt on a presidential candidate. We have seen a national convention of a major party that introduced an unexpected candidate for vice president. We have seen a former president address that convention and deliver an incoherent speech that took the energy out of it. We have seen the sitting president decide to stand down as a candidate for reelection. And then we saw the first instance in American history where a black woman, the child of immigrants from India and from Jamaica, suddenly was thrust into the national spotlight as a presidential candidate. All of this, that was in 10 days. And we kind of had that happen again and again throughout the year. And in the midst of this chaos, it is very, very difficult to deliver a message. I think the Democrats struggled in this campaign to deliver their message. It doesn't mean that they didn't. I think in many ways, structurally, Kamala Harris ran a very good campaign.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a lot. There was an arc. There was a plan. And as you say, in a number of these battleground states, my own state of Wisconsin, right? It's a marginal shift, right? This is a state that voted by about 22,000 votes for Trump in 16, voted by about 20,000 votes for Biden in 20. This year, it looks like about 30,000 votes for Trump, right? So it's this marginal thing. But what we have to understand is that while a lot of things went right, I do think there are a couple things that went wrong. And they were choices that were made that I don't think were necessarily wise. One of these was to spend an immense amount of time with Liz Cheney and the Republicans trying to find some way to win Republican votes. I want to tell you, you take a good serious look at the results from last night, you're going to find that didn't work very well. That didn't move the votes that people hoped or thought were going to move. In fact, that's exactly where a lot of things fell apart. So too much time with Liz Cheney, too little time in union halls with Sean Fain and Sarah Nelson and other union leaders to deliver an economic message. And polling tells us that people were really looking for that economic message. And an economic message that doesn't just say, boy, Biden gave you a great economy, but one that acknowledges pain, moves forward with a recognition of what you have to do. one other element of that too. Look, you know, everything about our history, and John, we've talked about this. Everything about our history tells us when a sitting president has led the country into a very unpopular foreign policy, right? Lyndon Johnson, Vietnam, Joe Biden, support for Israel as regards Gaza. When that president stands down, as Johnson did and as Biden did, and hands off the mantle of the party to another candidate, that candidate who steps in has to address that very unpopular foreign policy. And I know that Kamala Harris mentioned it at the convention and a couple other settings, but it was insufficient. And I think that as we look around the country and we see not just votes out of Michigan, which I think media covers this issue very badly because they think, oh, well, it's just a couple of towns in Michigan. And we shouldn't dismiss that. That's significant because very vital. But this is on campuses across the country. This is on, you know, in communities across the country. There are all sorts of people who really do care about this. And it just needed to be addressed.
Those are the fundamentals. I want to talk about the popular vote. Right now, Wednesday midday, they are saying Trump won the popular vote. That would be huge. The first time a Republican will have done that in 20 years, if it holds. But we don't yet have the vote from California, which usually makes the difference. Joe Biden 4 years ago got 9 million more votes than Trump did this year. So the real key here is the fall off in the Democratic vote. That's what we need to understand. And that's where the big question of what happened arises. And I think I'd like to look a little more at Wisconsin, your state. Trump ended up with 49.7%, less than 50%, let us note, but 1 point more than Harris. But incumbent Senator Tammy Baldwin won re-election by 1 point. How come Kamala lost and Tammy Baldwin won in Wisconsin?
It's a very, very good question. And look, I think there are so many factors, so many cross currents in this election that we should be careful about extrapolating from any one of them, right? I think we have to recognize that race and gender continue to be huge factors in how people make choices as regards politics, good choices and frankly choices that I disagree with on both sides of this, you know, the equation. We can't fail to recognize that. We also can't fail to recognize that this campaign saw the introduction of all sorts of incredibly crude attacks on Democrats as regards their stances on immigration, trans rights, a host of other issues. So all of that's in play there. And I don't want to miss any of that as we talk about this. But I will tell you one distinction in Wisconsin that is interesting is that Tammy Baldwin, who is a three-term, she would now be, she'd like to do a third term in the U.S. Senate, longtime political figure, faced a very, very wealthy opponent who spent lavishly and basically imported all of the Republican attacks against her, all the issues we're talking about, really brutal attacks. Happens that Baldwin is an out lesbian. She was even attacked in advertising, you know, with pictures of her partner, you know, and stuff like that. So this thing went to places that that I have not seen before in politics. It was staggeringly ugly. And yet, one of the things that Baldwin did that was fascinating was she remained resolute in her focus. You know, she had a plan from the start of the campaign, and she saw it through to the end. And there were times when she, you know, there'd be like a prominent figure come to the state and say, why isn't Tammy Baldwin appearing with that person? It wasn't that Baldwin was like trying to run away from the ticket. She appeared with Harris many times. But if she had a plan to go to some small town in Wisconsin, she went there, right? You know, she stuck to a plan that saw a vision for how to speak to the whole state. And as part of that, she never, ever lost sight of the multiracial, multiethnic working class of Wisconsin, factory workers, farmers, et cetera. Her ads were different than a lot of the ads you saw, the generic ads you saw for Democrats in other places. And to give you an example, she had ads on farms, right? With farmers in the barn. She had ads with shipbuilders talking about saving their industry up in Northeast Wisconsin. She had ads with Teamsters sitting on one team's after another, multiracial, multiethnic, men and women, sitting on a chair. Each one would sit on a chair, and they would talk about some aspect of what happened when they lost their pensions and when Tammy Baldwin fought to get their pensions back. And I will tell you that overall, that formed, even amidst all the negatives and the brutal attacks, that formed a narrative that I think helped her to get some portion of people who voted for Donald Trump to vote for a pretty progressive U.S. senator. And I think I mention all this only because it's my sense that in this very dark and very difficult moment, there are some lessons to learn about how to run a winning campaign. And we're seeing quite a few senators go down, quite a few senators who got beat, good senators in some cases. The fact that Baldwin pulled it off, I think is quite significant.
From the author of Putin's Wars comes.
Yes, The Nation magazine has ads on their podcast. I'll mention that I won't be getting to the deconstructed segment, but I will be getting to that tomorrow, I'm pretty sure, because the title of that one is... what is the title of that one? What Trump's Second Term Could Mean for the Middle East, with a round-robin discussion by quite a few people. I was going to play some... section of it that had implications for U.S. internal economics, like a bigger trade war than Trump's last one, the one that Biden didn't actually call off in any way, if you'll recall. Let's go back and see if I've got John Nichols and conversation with John Wiener from the podcast start making sense.
This election campaign, there are many people who voted for Kamala Harris because they really liked her, and I think a whole bunch of people voted for her for that reason. There's another bunch of people who voted for her because they don't like Trump, right? But what we have to understand is that in a dynamic where, you know, people are voting for one candidate because they like him, but also sometimes against things like that, that for Trump, I think he recognized, his campaign recognized early on that those numbers that you just cited, I think those are probably consistent numbers throughout the campaign. And so what they sought to do was to make more people dislike Kamala Harris, right?
Yeah.
To
yeah.
throw so many negatives at her that it would, you know, bring the debate down to a level where Trump could get a vote from someone who didn't even like Trump, right? And I saw it in Wisconsin. I would see ad after ad after ad. They never referred to her as the vice president or Kamala Harris. They referred to her as Kamala. Right. And they were brutally negative and blamed her for everything you can imagine, and even went to levels. I mean, the claims about her stance on immigrants, on trans rights, on a host of other issues were just so over the top. Right. And yet they, when you put tens of millions of dollars behind that, I think it has some impact. And so, again, you can dislike Donald Trump, but if Donald Trump makes you dislike somebody else more than him, you open up that potential that he gets the vote. And I think you saw some of that.
One of the most dismaying things about the election 4 years ago was the way Trump won 52% of white women and turns 53%. Last 4 years ago, he won 53% of white women. Turns out this year, at least according to the CNN exit poll, he won 52% of white women. This is after he said he would protect women, whether the women like it or not. He always painted these terrifying scenes of, you know, criminals, immigrants, murderers breaking into the kitchens of women while they're home alone and cutting their throats. So he did pose as the defender of endangered women. It seems like the white women still like Donald Trump, even though a lot of them voted for the abortion referenda in their states.
Absolutely. And look at that. Again, we spoke a moment ago about Donald Trump or about Kamala Harris's campaign's efforts to reach out to suburban women, especially Republicans, with lots of appearances with Liz Cheney. And she did multiple appearances in Wisconsin with Liz Cheney. That just didn't gain much traction. There's very little evidence that that worked. And so then we ask a strategic question. I think this is an important one, you know, if we learn from an election result. And that is, what might she have done differently, right, to get, you know, where she needed to be? Well, I can tell you, on the Madison campus, there was underperformance for the Democrats, right? Young people, there was not a connection there. I would go so far as to say that not just appearances, and, you know, yeah, she did appearances with some celebrities and things like that, but policy and really kind of an outreach that focuses on fundamental issues, who's very popular with young people to this day. I saw it just a week or so ago in Madison, Bernie Sanders. But Kamala Harris didn't appear with Bernie Sanders. She appeared with Liz Cheney. She didn't appear until the last day with AOC, right? But she appeared with all sorts of Republicans. I would suggest to you that first and foremost, a policy shift on some of these issues we're talking about, not just Gaza, but also on, you know, a real sense of economic opportunity for young people going forward might have had a major impact with people who she could actually win over. Not going kind of trying to swing Republicans, but swinging what Reverend Barber refers to as that broad mass of people, many of them young, who incline toward progressive positions, but do need to be invited into the process, do need to be invited to cast their vote. So I think that's at the heart of it, John, is that there was a misfocus. Even though I'm very complimentary to some aspects of the campaign, I think there was a misfocus on where the outreach needed to be, and the outreach needed to be toward bringing in people who are on your side, not convincing people who actually don't agree with you on a host of issues that they should vote for you because they don't like Donald Trump.
Also want to ask about Latino men. We were told throughout the campaign that the polls showed that Latino men were switching their allegiance to the Republicans, and that CNN exit poll showed that a majority of Latino men, 54%, voted for Trump. What do you think is going on there? The simplest explanation is Latino men don't want to vote for a black woman.
I think it's a lot more of it than that. You know, I think that one thing is every community, every demographic has diversity within it, right?
Yeah.
And this isn't, we have a long history of you know, seeing folks who may vote for someone that I don't agree with or you don't agree with, but they actually agree with them, right? For whatever reason or whatever issue. And I think we have to respect that and recognize that. My sense is that, again, this comes back to a couple of things. First and foremost, yes, race and gender. We recognize that those are not just, those are deep, deep challenges that exist in our society and have not gone away. And that first you have to recognize. But you also recognize that there are a lot of folks who are strivers economically, right? They want to make it in America, but they also want to have at least some base of social safety. And I think Kamala Harris took a great stand in favor of a care economy. Right. And, you know, getting people the aid they need to care for their elderly parents, to care for themselves if they're in a difficult situation, to expand Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. Those are great positions for multiracial, multiethnic outreach, and including to, I would argue, Latino men and others. But that wasn't always central to her appeal when she went out and talked about what she was trying to do. And I think this is the problem. There was so much talk about how divisive Donald Trump was. What a bad player Donald Trump was. Well, true, I agree with it. But there wasn't enough talk about what you wanted to get to, what you wanted to achieve, what you want to give people or get people if you're elected president. And I think that at the end of the day, rather than suggesting somebody didn't vote for somebody because they didn't like this or they didn't like that, I think it's important to understand that in many cases, people of across the spectrum were not given enough of a sense of what might happen to the good in their lives if Kamala Harris was elected.
There's one thing we certainly don't know the final vote on yet, and that's the composition of the House of Representatives.
Yeah.
If Democrats regain control of the House, largely it would be because of elections which are as yet unresolved in California, Oregon, and Washington. That would be a kind of firewall against much of the worst of what Trump as president could do. Let's talk about that for a minute.
It's a huge deal, John. I said before the election, and I might even said it to you, that I thought that this would not be a close result. I thought that it would break one way or the other. It would either break toward Harris, and she would probably achieve a result similar to Barack Obama in 2012, an incumbent party seeking re-election that won the presidency and then won the Senate, and maybe didn't make as much progress in the House as it wanted, but did a little bit there. That was a positive scenario, with little variations. The other was a Reagan 1980, right? That a challenger to an incumbent party surged at the end, won the presidency, flipped a whole lot of Senate seats, and had an opposing House, but a House that had to define itself in that new context. Well, I think we've ended up with the Reagan scenario, but it's much worse because Trump is, I think, a worse player than Reagan, and also he has much more control of his party. So in that scenario, what we have to remember is that the House of Representatives was a challenge for Ronald Reagan. He did have to compromise with it on some issues, and it's good to study that. It's good to think about that. It's also good to recognize that one of the dangers in so divided a moment is that the folks who are supposed to be the opposition start out saying, oh, well, we want to find ways to work with everybody. We want to find ways to cooperate. It is fine to cooperate on Donald Trump if he's doing something really good.
Don't hold your breath. That's John Nichols, and I have to excerpt that on the fly because I guess I was talking too much again. That's the Nation podcast called Start Making Sense, John Nichols, and it's on the 5th, so maybe some of those figures, ratios, were wrong about turnout. We're still sorting it out because there's still seats that haven't been finished. They're counting. Thanks for listening. Opinions are those of the speakers. This is WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored, volunteer-operated radio, and I do have the right underwriting announcement to stick in right here. It'll give me a moment. Radio Free Labor, coming at you.